Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. What exactly is going on between the U.S. and Iran right now? U.S. personnel being pulled from the embassy in Baghdad because of unspecified threats, Saudi oil tankers sabotaged, but how and by whom? By Iran, says the Pentagon, offering no evidence just yet. The White House says, we don't want war, but it has been ratcheting up the tensions. Iran also says it doesn't want war, but it has given Europeans a mere 60 days to figure out how to work around U.S. sanctions, or else Tehran says it will start enriching uranium. America's European allies are directly contradicting Washington and saying, let's take this down a notch. Talk about the fog of war. This hour on Point, the U.S. amps up the pressure on Iran, and you can join us. Do you understand what's going on, what's actually going on right now? Do you hear the clang of saber rattling or something more? When Russia, for example, warns the U.S. and Iran of a downward spiral, does that concern you? And then there's this fact that John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, has promised regime change repeatedly in Iran by 2019. Is that where this is headed? Is that where you want to go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start first today in Washington with Nancy Youssef, National Security Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit more about this announcement today that the State Department has made about removing non-essential personnel from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad? What's going on there?
So the announcement was that any sort of non-essential personnel would be moved out because of sort of increased tensions and the concern about escalating threats between the U.S. and Iran. And it's quite surprising because as recently as Sunday, they were saying that personnel should sort of be on a heightened level of awareness. And so I think this announcement, in the wake of a lot of the things that you mentioned in the opening, has sort of raised concerns again about the possibility of escalating tensions, about escalating actions between Iran and the United States, and that there are specific threats being pointed at either U.S. personnel, diplomats, or U.S. troops that are operating in Iraq.
But we don't have any further information, public information as of yet, regarding what those threats.
No, I mean, everything we know about the threats has been through unnamed officials. Nobody has specified on the record from the Pentagon or from the White House what precisely the threats are. What they've said is that the threats are to troops and personnel in Iraq, in Syria, and in the waters in the region. But everything we've heard has been through anonymous sourcing, intelligence picking up increased surveillance or increased movement or increased threats on troops or increased chatter about attacking or threatening U.S. personnel in the region.
Okay. So just yesterday, the president responded to this really big report from the New York Times that the Pentagon has handed him plans or has created plans to send as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East if Iran does attack American forces or accelerates its work on its nuclear program. So here's how the president responded to that Times report.
Now, would I do that? Absolutely. But we have not planned for that. Hopefully, we're not going to have to plan for that. And if we did that, we'd send a hell of a lot more troops than that.
That's the president yesterday. Initially, he denied the New York Times report and then went on to say what we just heard. Nancy, so tell us about this. I mean, about the 120,000 troops and where the White House does stand on further escalating a military presence in the region.
So on the 120,000 troops, let me just sort of preface and say that the Pentagon has plans for lots of options. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's being executed or that it's being carried out. When the New York Times story talked about a plan put forward by the acting defense secretary to the White House at a meeting that proposed 120,000 troops, the story didn't say where those troops would be based and what their mission would be other than they would not be there for regime change. In terms of your broader question about what the sort of U.S. calculus is, it's a great question, and it's one we haven't really gotten clear answers on. Some of the theories are that you know, if you think of the U.S. and Iran as sort of two pythons that are sort of intertwined, and one's putting pressure on the other, and that's leading the other to react, that because the United States has put increased sanction pressures on Iran because it declared the IRGC its paramilitary force, a terrorist organization earlier this year, that the crippling sanctions pressure has led Iran to sort of react and signal its ability to sort of respond, and that both sides are sort of creating tensions amongst one another because of the perceived threat from the each side, and that because of that, that it could lead to an escalatory action. Another argument, and sort of more optimistic one, is that both sides are sort of showing their leverage, if you will, to sort of lay the groundwork and give themselves the best position in the if there are eventual talks between the two sides. That is, that Iran wants to signal to the world that they are a force to be reckoned with, and that they want to see Europe and other partners kind of express concerns, such that they will push to talks for Iran to get sanctions relief, and from the United States perspective, to get Iran to stop what it sees as malign activity throughout the region. And so you raise a great question right now. I think it's ambiguous, and arguably purposely ambiguous, because each side wants to kind of keep the other, if you will, on its toes and uncertain about what its adversary is going to do next.
Well, Nancy Youssef, national security correspondent from The Wall Street Journal, joining us from Washington. Nancy, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Ruel Marc Gerecht. He's joining us also from Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, former Middle East specialist at the CIA's Directorate of Operations, and former director of the Middle East Initiative at the Project for the New American Century. Ruel Marc Gerecht, welcome to you.
My pleasure.
Okay. So where is this headed? I mean, given that John Bolton has said for years that his number one goal, he believes the stated goal of the United States official policy should be regime change in Iran. Are we seeing sort of the political theater leading up to that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think the administration has decided that taking an incremental approach with the Islamic Republic hasn't been successful. So they intend to use maximum economic pressure, and they are taking precautions, certainly, that to let the regime know that they have the intention to use they're willing to use military force if the Islamic Republic does certain actions. Now, whether the president of the United States is actually willing to do that, we don't know. I think the leadership, certainly the supreme leader in Iran, does fear that the United States might be willing to use force, and for that reason has been very careful and cautious in their actions.
Now, U.S. allies are reacting quite markedly to the escalation coming from Washington. Let's listen to what British Army Major General Chris Gyka had to say to reporters at the Pentagon yesterday in a video conference. Gyka is the deputy commander for stability with the Allied mission in Iraq. Now, he directly contradicted the Pentagon's reports of serious new threats from Iran-backed elements of the PMF, or Popular Mobilization Forces. Now, this matters because the PMF, including its Iran-backed militias, were a key part of the effort to defeat ISIS in Iraq. And here's what Gyka said.
We've seen no change in the posture or the laydown of the PMF. Many of them are compliant, and we have seen, as I say, no change in their posture since the recent exchange between the United States and Iran.
Okay, so meaning there that Gyka is saying Iran-backed militias essentially fought alongside the U.S. and allies to defeat ISIS. But then Gyka went on, unasked, to say this.
There is a broader point, I think, about Iran while we're on the subject. And I want to make quite clear that we are a counter-Daesh mission. I have no part of Iran in any of my orders, in any of my directives, or in any of my planning documents. Iran is no part of our mission. I just want to put that one out there because I think it's really important at this stage.
Ruel Marc Gerecht, why would Gyka say that?
I think probably because of fear. I think, and also because he's stating accurately the British position. I think he wants it to be known that the British have no hostile intentions towards the Islamic Republic. Therefore, the Islamic Republic should now have no hostile intentions towards British personnel. I'm aware of no operational mandate from the White House that would instruct U.S. forces to attack the Islamic Republic. I think what we're seeing happen is simply better safe than sorry, and that they're letting the Iranians know that they are prepared for escalation. I don't think the President of the United States has any intention of shooting first. I don't think that John Bolton has any intention of shooting first, but I think this is part of a ground game which is prepared to use or at least threaten the use of hard power.
It's interesting, though, because when Russia warns of avoiding a downward spiral, isn't it possible that the preparation for escalation, as you said, could be the very thing that leads to an escalation?
I doubt. I mean, I think the more dangerous route is to show weakness towards the Islamic Republic. They do have a tendency to exploit that. And I think, given the Supreme Leader's comments that he made quite recently, that they need to be very careful about provoking the United States, I would say that the course of action there is the correct one. You want to keep the clerical regime off balance. You want to ensure that they believe that you are prepared to use force.
Well, we've got comments coming in here. Ray Russell says, never trust Iran. Their policy is destruction of the U.S. and its Western allies. Keep sanctions on Iran until there's another internal revolution. Carl Denham says, it's been well established that the United States of America in the U.S. that when a president wants to divert from his own domestic issues, he starts a war. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about exactly what's happening between Washington and Tehran right now. The U.S. has said in the past week that it's sending an aircraft carrier, an amphibious assault ship, a bomber task force, and an anti-missile system to the region after intelligence assessments purportedly show Iran is posing a threat to U.S. assets and troops in the region. We're joined today by Ruel Marc Gerecht. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And let's listen to a little bit more of what both American officials and U.S. allies are saying about the increasing tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Here's Jeremy Hunt, Britain's foreign secretary, speaking to Sky News on Monday.
We are very worried about the risk of a conflict happening by accident with an escalation that is unintended really on either side, but ends with some kind of conflict. And so we'll be sharing those concerns with my European counterparts, with Mike Pompeo. And I think what we need is a period of calm to make sure that everyone understands what the other side is thinking.
Well, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did sit down with CNBC correspondent Natasha Turok before he headed off to Europe to rally support from allies. Turok said that Pentagon officials and allies in the Middle East are worried that the U.S. or Iran might miscalculate.
We're not going to miscalculate. Our aim is not war. Our aim is a change in the behavior of the Iranian leadership. But the president wanted to make sure that in the event that something took place, we were prepared to respond to it in an appropriate way. And as the Secretary of State, I wanted to make sure that we had all the political diplomatic tools in the right place. And we want to make sure that we can provide the president with an option set in the event that the Iranians make a bad decision.
That's the Secretary of State responding to Natasha Turok's question there. Joining us now is Stephen Walt. He's a professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a contributing editor at Foreign Policy magazine. His latest piece in Foreign Policy magazine is headlined, "If Nobody Knows Your Iran Policy, Does It Even Exist?" And we've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Stephen Walt, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here.
So first, let's start off with this question or this concern about potential miscalculation here. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, it's always a possibility when you have, first of all, a bad relationship between two countries and you have military forces in some proximity to one another. We still have a substantial set of forces in the region. We are sending more there. Iran has actually quite modest military capabilities, but there's some possibility that either Iranian-backed militias or Iranian forces of one kind or another get tangled up with American forces in one way or another, and that becomes either a pretext for war or something that leads to a conflict by accident. So anytime you see something like this, it's cause for at least some concern.
Okay. And so then what do you think could be the potential next steps?
Well, this is the great puzzle. I don't think know what the Trump administration actually is trying to accomplish here, whether this is sort of just largely symbolic, whether this is an attempt to put pressure on Iran so that they'll negotiate some kind of new nuclear deal, something the president has talked about occasionally. Secretary Pompeo has talked about trying to get Iran to act like a normal country. Without defining what a normal country is, and that's an interesting question in its own right. And then there's the question that maybe we're putting all this pressure on Iran because we really do want regime change, something John Bolton and others have pushed for. I think that's very unlikely to happen. It might not even lead to better results, but that could be part of their objective. Or perhaps this is seen as a way to try and goad Iran into eventually leaving the nuclear deal, which would then put us back in the position of having to decide if we were willing to use force to try and remove the rest of their nuclear capability. So there's a lot of different possibilities here. And the administration, which I don't think is terrific at laying out its objectives, has not said exactly what it thinks it's trying to accomplish here.
Okay, so I want to just grapple head on with what John Bolton wants here, right? Because he's the national security advisor. And, you know, I hear both you and Ruel Marc Gerecht saying that you don't think that regime change in Iran is likely going to happen, but could the effort be made to try to make it happen? And here's why I ask, because Bolton has been saying this for years, and as recently as July 2017, you know, before he became not long before he became national security advisor, he was speaking to a convention of the Iranian dissident group, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, or the MEK. Now, the MEK is generally recognized by American experts or observers of the region and other experts as a dissident group that tends towards perhaps some even call it a cult. But Bolton was speaking before their group in Paris in 2017, promising something rather critical would happen by this year, by 2019. And here's what he said.
I had said for over 10 years since coming to these events that the declared policy of the United States of America should be the overthrow of the mullah's regime in Tehran. The behavior and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself. And that's why before 2019, we here will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much.
That's John Bolton in July 2017. So, Stephen Wall, I'll start with you. How much clearer can the man who's now the national security advisor to the United States be when he says he believes this should be the stated objective of the United States?
I think in that case, he's sincere. The question is, how far is he, and more importantly, how far is Donald Trump willing to go to try and pull that off? And by the way, you could favor regime change and not necessarily favor some kind of preventive war. You could believe, for example, you could do it all by putting economic pressure. Eventually, the Iranian people will rise up, overthrow the mullahs.
Call me a cynic about this, though, but the fact that he labeled 2019 as the year to do it, I mean, that's – look, it's the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. This is a man who might love the narrative of pulling this off by 2019.
I'm sure he would like that. But again, first of all, I think the likelihood that you can do this with economic pressure alone is rather slim. Our efforts to do that in other cases with other countries, whether it's Cuba or Libya or Iraq back under Saddam, didn't succeed as well. A more subtle possibility is that this is a way of sort of moving a reluctant president towards a more confrontational position. In other words, Trump has expressed his own reluctance to do this, his criticisms of past U.S. wars in the Middle East, which I think is correct in this case. But, you know, what if Bolton comes back to Trump in a year and says, well, we tried maximum pressure. It didn't really work. The Iranians haven't changed. And now you look weak. You've failed, or our policy has failed. We're going to need to do more. We don't know what this particular president would do. He is good at sometimes reversing course without appearing or without admitting that he's reversing course. And so one possibility, and none of us know exactly what's in Mr. Bolton's head, but one possibility is that, well, if he gets regime change, that's great. And if he doesn't get regime change by the end of 2019, then it will be time to push the president to try and do something more. Well, I would just add that, you know, we ought to remember that starting wars in the Middle East has not been working out particularly well for the United States in recent years, and I hope the president still remembers that.
To put it lightly, Reuel Marc Gerecht, I mean, you heard that tape from John Bolton. He's saying that he doesn't believe the regime is going to change at all on its own. So what do you make of what Bolton has said consistently?
Well, that was a typically emotionally exuberant moment for Mr. Bolton. You know, I think there are differences of opinion inside the administration. The one thing I think they agree on now is that it's best not to let the clerical regime have more money, that if you can deny them billions of dollars worth of hard currency, that it's best to do that with a virulently anti-American Islamist regime. Beyond that, I think there are real differences of opinion. And I think, the only area that there is consensus on is the use of sanctions. Mm-hmm. Now, does John Bolton believe that sanctions pressure will collapse the clerical regime? I suspect not. My knowledge of Mr. Bolton, but I don't know. I mean, there are people in this town who are quite exuberant about the possibilities of sanctions, and we certainly use sanctions more intelligently and aggressively than we have in the past. But I don't see any other plans on the table. I'm skeptical that this is a stepping stone to military confrontation. I suppose if the regime attempted to use asymmetrical, and they use that word quite a lot, mm-hmm. particularly the Revolutionary Guard Corps does in its publications, asymmetrical means to retaliate against the United States, that might provoke conflict. I suppose if they attempted to ramp up uranium enrichment in a significant way, and I don't expect them to do that. I would expect them to do it in very small increments. That might provoke conflict, but otherwise I doubt it. I think it's important to note that the Israelis have been putting an enormous amount of pressure on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria since last May. They've been pummeling them on a regular basis with air power, and the Iranians have done virtually nothing in response, and I think that's probably quite instructive.
Huh. Well, let's listen to what the president himself says about John Bolton. Last week, President Trump was asked by reporters if he's satisfied with the advice he received from his national security advisor. And here's what President Trump said.
He has strong views on things, but that's okay. I actually temper John, which is pretty amazing, isn't it?
Nobody thought that was going to happen. I'm the one that tempers him, but that's okay. I have different sides. I mean, I have John Bolton, and I have other people that are a little more dovish than him. And ultimately, I make the decision. No, I like John. I get very good advice from John.
That's the president just last week. Let's go to our phones. Barry is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Barry, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I thought I had questions, but they're really comments as I sat here and rounded them out. But the first thing is, this is another inexperienced draft-dodging president who wants to take us to war, wants to play fast and loose with American lives. And I'd rather him not play with my son's life, play with his own son's life. Second comment is, the Secretary of Defense is who? Boeing? Boeing is his experience? That's great. Third is, we're backing Iran into a corner. Just like any other animal, you back an animal into a corner, it's fight or flight. They have nowhere to run, so they're going to have to fight. Mm. And so we're making this happen. The USS Maine in Cuba, the Gulf of Tonkin, Vietnam, Saddam Hussein's buying yellow cake uranium in Africa, Noriega in Panama was selling drugs. We always come up with something when we want to start a war.
Mm. Barry, thank you so much for your call. Stephen Walt, you want to respond to him?
Well, I'll say two things. One is, I think one of the reasons people are concerned is that there are at least echoes here of what happened in 2002, 2003, with stories being planted or leaked about various nefarious Iranian activities, movement of troops, accusations that our allies immediately question, and some of the same people are playing or running that playbook. And, of course, we've already talked about Mr. Bolton. So I think that's one of the reasons people react, and appropriately so. But in this case, I'm no fan of President Trump, but his position thus far as president has been to be actually relatively skeptical about the ability to use military force. He has used it on a number of occasions. He's doing a lot of counterterrorist activities. He did fire some cruise missiles into Syria at one point early on in his presidency. But by and large, he has remained skeptical about the ability of military power to accomplish great miracles. And the quotation we listened to suggested that, you know, yes, he gets advice from Bolton, who he recognizes is more hawkish. But thus far, this is a president who I think has correctly understood that another substantial war in the Middle East with the potential to escalate in a variety of ways that we would find unpleasant, not necessarily here in the United States, but elsewhere in the region, is one of the things that could damage his reelection prospects. And I think this is a president who cares more than anything else about his own personal popularity and his own ability to get reelected, and that might be the one major break on what the United States is doing in the region here.
And we should note also that our caller, Barry, had mentioned the Secretary of Defense and Boeing. I believe he was referring to Patrick Shanahan, who's still technically, I think, the acting Secretary of Defense, whose previous employer was Boeing. So let's go back to the calls. Badad is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to make a couple comments. I'm an Iranian American, and my father just went to Iran for the first time since they emigrated here in the 80s. And the things that he's been telling me are completely different from the narrative that we hear from people like John Bolton and Donald Trump. The Iranian people are doing really well. They're very happy. I'm sure that the economic sanctions are pinching them in a way. But, you know, as far as like civil liberties go, civil rights, it seems like it's the best it's been in a long time, especially since my parents left. The other comment I wanted to make was, I just wonder, you know, if you pay attention to the history of the Iranian and U.S. relation over the past 100 years, this happens over and over again. There's always someone like John Bolton who says we need regime change. Let's not forget that this theocracy was established by the Iranian people because of regime change that was perpetuated by the U.S. when they deposed Mohammad Mossadegh and put the Reza Shah in there. So I guess I just would caution the American people, like, why is John Bolton and Donald Trump so interested in war with Iran when it really does nothing for them or the American people?
Mm. Well, Badad, thank you so much for your call. Ruel Mark Gerecht, would you like to respond to him?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a broad consensus in Washington on both the Democratic and Republican side that if you could snap your fingers and have regime change in the Islamic Republic, you would do it. Lord, I've had happy conversations about the collapse of the clerical regime with German officials, who are the most pacific of our European allies. So the issue is, you know, what would you want to do? Do you think you can engage in some actions that would be helpful in that direction? Or do you believe in engagement in that capitalism, commerce can soothe the savage beast? I think it's fair to say that the administration is quite dubious on the notion of engagement, that giving the Islamic Republic billions of dollars is not going to moderate the Islamic Republic. It's just going to make it stronger. There's a lot about the Iran policy of this administration that doesn't make a lot of sense. And part of that is because it is unwilling to do certain things. Most of those things would have to do with applying pressure to the Islamic Republic's aggression regionally. So you're not going to have a type of containment strategy that, say, you had against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. You're just going to have, I think, the use of sanctions and probably not that much else.
Well, we are talking about escalating tensions between Washington and Tehran. Send us a comment online at Facebook and Twitter. We're at On Point Radio, and we will be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about exactly what is going on between Washington and Tehran. And I'm joined today by Stephen Walt. He's professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, contributing editor at Foreign Policy magazine. He's also author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Ruel Marc Gerecht also joins us. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a former Middle East specialist at the CIA's Directorate of Operations. Well, let's listen to a little bit about what Iranian officials have been saying. Last month, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was in New York, and he spoke at the Asia Society as the U.S. was ratcheting up pressure on Iran. And Zarif said he understands superpower hardball, but he claims that attempts to humiliate Iran will not work.
Our dignity is not up for sale. President Trump believes that by pushing us, by imposing economic pressure on us, we will sell our dignity. Not going to happen.
That's the Iranian foreign minister last month. Fast forward a little bit, and after news that two Saudi and two other tankers were apparently sabotaged on Monday, and the U.S. Claims that it now may be the Iranian military that had a hand in that, reporters pressed the president yesterday at a photo op in the Oval Office on the situation. And here, courtesy of the Associated Press, is what the president said.
We'll see what happens with Iran. If they do anything, it will be a very bad mistake. If they do anything, I'm hearing little stories about Iran. If they do anything, they will suffer greatly. We'll see what happens with Iran. It's going to be a bad problem for Iran if something happens, I can tell you that. They're not going to be happy. They are not going to be happy people. Okay? You can figure it out yourself. They know what I mean by it.
That's the president little earlier this week. Now, Stephen Walt, I want to turn back to you on something here, because we've been talking a lot about what the plans or intentions of Washington might be. But in Tehran, we're hearing over the past few days that the Iranian government is saying to European allies, for example, we're giving you 60 days to figure out ways around a new U.S. sanctions. Or else Iran threatens to start enriching uranium at levels that violate the Iran nuclear deal here. So, I mean, if there's an escalation of tensions, Tehran's playing its part too, is it not?
I don't think so. Not nearly to the same extent. I mean, the United States has done a variety of things, and, you know, announcing a policy of maximum pressure is a signal in a certain sense. We've already talked about the desire for regime change, which is something, you know, that Iran is not threatening us with in particular ways. We're not talking about – we're not seeing Iran suddenly sending military forces to the Caribbean or anything like that. Their response to maximum pressure has been rather minimal, in fact. And the recent hints that they might depart from parts, not all, but just parts of the nuclear agreement, I think is, again, a rather minimal response. What they've said is, for example, that they might not ship low-enriched uranium. This is not weapons grade. This is low-enriched uranium, and the agreement limits them to a certain stockpile. Right? They might exceed that stockpile. They would no longer be shipping sufficient low-enriched uranium out of the country. This is a very modest step, and of course, it's a easily reversible step. If they've gone over the limit and they were to get an agreement from the Europeans, then they could immediately ship the rest of it out. This is an attempt, essentially, to get Europe, Russia, and China, the other participants in the nuclear agreement, to deliver what Iran expected from the agreement. And it's worth remembering that Iran has adhered, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency and according to American intelligence services, has completely adhered to the nuclear agreement, even though the United States walked away from it a year ago. What the Iranians are now attempting to do is get their other signatories to the agreement to actually live up to the terms.
Well, we're seeing here, though, that Russian President Vladimir Putin, since you mentioned Russia, says he's urging Iran to stick to all parts of the nuclear deal. And Putin apparently is saying that if Iran begins to backtrack on its commitments, that everyone will end up blaming it on Iran, even though this was the U.S. that pulled out of the deal here.
Yeah, I think that's actually a mistake. Other countries may, in fact, be very upset if Iran leaves it, because they understood something I think the Trump administration did not understand, that the agreement, if not perfect, was a very good deal for everyone. Good for Iran, good for the United States, good for Europe, good for Russia, good for China. And they would like it to continue. They would like Iran not to take any steps that would further erode it, even though they understand the problem here began in Washington, not in Tehran.
Ruel Markgerecht, what do you think about that?
Which part?
Well, first of all, let me start with the first part that I asked Stephen Walt about, that Iran saying that, you know, you get help us get around these sanctions or we'll start enriching uranium into levels that violate the nuclear agreement.
Well, I think that's part of the traditional Iranian playbook when it comes to its nuclear advance. That is, they try to make incremental gains. And then you accept those gains, then they increase them. That's what they did throughout the 1990s and during the Bush 2 administration. So that's not at all surprising. I think what's worthy to note, again, has been the restrained response on the part of the Islamic Republic. I think that's done for three reasons. One is they fear the Trump administration. I think when a Revolutionary Guard Corps publication, a major one, calls John Bolton a raging bull, that's a good thing. I think they are deeply concerned about American military power. I think they're also concerned about internal stability in the country, that they want no part of to test the system. They've had a great deal of disquiet in the country, and I don't think they wish to put pressure on the internal politics. I also think that the nuclear deal is such a good one for them that they can continue to do what they want to do, which is advance centrifuge research and development, particularly the IR-6 and IR-8 advanced centrifuges, which are high-velocity machines. They can do that under the agreement. And we know from the archives that were snitched by Mossad in Iran that they have continued a clandestine program after 2003 of developing the component parts of a weapon, particularly nuclear triggers. So they have more or less in a position to do what they want to do and maintain that agreement. The annoying part for them is that they're not getting the money that they had wanted that came with the deal. And so that's the real rub. And the Europeans have failed them. I think that's why the Supreme Leader authorized terrorist operations, for example, in France and in Denmark, was because he was expressing his utter contempt for the Europeans because they failed to uphold their part of the bargain. And they have, in his mind, I think, displayed obsequiousness towards the United States.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi. It seems somewhat specious to talk about the nuclear Iran faux deal. We have no idea what they're actually doing, what they have where these facilities located, and how much of anything they produced. It's a game. They have this nice curtain to hide behind for the Europeans and try and get their money while not getting ours. And the Europeans have the same curtain to say, oh, gee, they're living up to this faux agreement. It's absurd.
Joe, thank you for your call. Stephen Walt, do we actually not know what Iran is doing?
I think we have a very good idea what Iran is doing. The Central Intelligence Agency has said since 2007 that Iran had no active nuclear weapons program. We know that they had been working on nuclear weapons in the past, but they were not doing that. They have an enrichment program. They have all of the technical capabilities to develop nuclear weapons if they wish to, but they are not currently doing so. That's been confirmed also by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And it's worth noting that even now, Iran is under more extensive nuclear inspections than any other country in history. So I think that in this case, the caller is believing propaganda rather than what's really happening. I wanted to go back to something else that you pointed out, which was the Zarif quotation about, you know, Iran not selling its dignity. I think that's actually a very important point here. Iran has been under a great deal of pressure at various times in its history, and it doesn't make concessions easily. And there's actually a good logical reason for this. Countries don't like giving in to blackmail. They don't like being forced to make enormous concessions, because if you allow a more powerful adversary to do that once, then, of course, they can do it again. They'll come back. And I think that's a particular problem for the Trump administration, which, let's just say, doesn't have the greatest reputation for telling the truth, for being credible, for being necessarily reliable. So why should Iran believe any offers that they bring forward if they agree to do something because we have twisted their arm to the breaking point, right? Then, of course, we've proven that we can keep doing that. And so I think they have very strong incentives from a purely Iranian perspective not to make concessions to the United States. Not that if we got any kind of subsequent agreement with them, it's going to have something in it for them. It can't be just us imposing unilateral demands and they're agreeing to them. There has to be some give and take in here, or the Iranians will never agree to it. That's worth remembering that the United States had very maximalist demands on Iran from 2000 to 2015. Basically, our position was you have to give up all enrichment capacity. And in that period, even as sanctions got tighter and tighter and tighter, Iran went from having zero centrifuges in operation in 2000 to 19,000 by 2015 or so. So I think we have a record here that if you're going to reach any kind of an agreement with Iran, it's going to have a lot in it for us, but it's going to have something in it for Iran as well. And pressure alone is not going to get us there.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Madeline, who's calling from De Pere, Wisconsin. Madeline, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to say, you know, the investigations are heating up in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump Jr. is going to be testifying. This man would do anything to President Trump. He would do anything to detract from the destruction of himself and his family and all his regime, even start a war. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is my belief.
Well, Madeline, thank you very much for your call. Let's get one more call. Let's go to Ali, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Ali, you're on the air.
Hello. My name is Ali. I just came back from Iran, and Iranian people are very, very unhappy about being bullied by the U.S. They feel they made agreement with the U.S. and U.S. pulled out, and now they're being sanctioned for all the causes, and now they're going to have a war. People in Iran are starving. I had to take formula for my niece to be sure she has food. This is not fair assessment. You know, being an Iranian American and not, you know, pro-regime or anti-regime, they all are united in this, that the U.S. should keep its hands off of our country. Mm-hmm. Iran has not been an aggressor here. Iran has done nothing wrong. And they really, really want U.S. to stay away. And Iranian people love U.S. people. There's no question in my mind. Mm.
Well, Ali, thank you for your call. Ruel Mark Gerecht, would you like to respond to Ali's thoughts?
Yeah, I would just say this. I mean, there have been ongoing provincial demonstrations in Iran since December of last year. And it is noteworthy. These are not of the magnitude of the 2 to 3 million strong demonstrations against the regime that occurred in 2009, primarily in Tehran, but also in some provincial cities. But it is striking that when you look, and there's been a lot of video coverage of these demonstrations, you don't see them rising up and chanting against President Trump. You see them chanting against their own government. So I am somewhat dubious of the proposition that the primary anger internally is directed outward towards the United States. That hasn't been the history of internal dissent since it started to kick into high gear in the late 1980s. I don't think it's true today.
Mm. Well, Stephen Walt, though, Ali also saying that, you know, in terms of he can see it in members of his own family feeling the bite of those sanctions.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. And that actually poses a sort of interesting paradox or even contradiction. You know, we're constantly told here in the United States that Iran is this extraordinary threat to us, that it's very powerful, that there's an emerging Persian empire of sorts in the Middle East. And this is mostly just nonsense. We clearly have disagreements with Iran. There are points of friction between us. But Iran is, in fact, a rather weak country compared to the United States. Its population is substantially smaller. Our allies in the Middle East spend five times more than Iran does on its military. Iran's military budget is about $20 billion a year. America's is $600 billion, et cetera. They have a number of clients in various places, but they don't control these clients, and these clients don't pose a direct threat to the United States, and certainly not to American soil as well.
But American allies, to the Saudis, to Israel.
To the Saudis and Israel and Egypt are all substantially more powerful than Iran is. And if they are worried about it, that it's possible that they may have to take action, but the United States doesn't necessarily have to take the lead in doing this. And all of those allies, by the way, are increasingly problematic in various ways. If you asked who has been destabilizing the Middle East more in recent years, you could point to Saudi Arabia as much as you could point to Iran as well. So, I mean, part of the problem in all of this is that we have, I think, a picture of Iran and its power. And again, we're told that it's powerful, it's dangerous, we've got to do something about it. And then we're also told it's going to be relatively easy to deal with it. There's nothing really they can do. And as we've heard in some of Ruhl's comments, you know, that they're actually very fearful of us. Well, you kind of can't have it both ways. Either they're powerful, malevolent, dangerous, and have to be stopped, or they're relatively weak and vulnerable and are going to be easy to take care of. You kind of have to make up our minds which of those is.
Well, Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a contributing editor at Foreign Policy magazine, also author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Stephen Walt, always great to have you. Thank you so very much.
Nice to be here.
And Ruel Mark Gerecht, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and former Middle East specialist at the CIA's Directorate of Operations. Ruel Mark Gerecht, always great to have you as well. Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.